This podcast is brought to you by Hound. Hound comments on style violations and GitHub pull requests, allowing you and your team to better review and maintain a clean code base. Try it now at houndci.com.
Quick show. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Derek.
I removed database cleaner from a bunch of projects lately.
Ah, you switched to system tests.
So I didn't switch to system tests.
You just stopped using the database.
No. So this is what confuses me. It works fine through several test runs.
Are these not integration tests?
They are our spec feature tests, and they work just fine.
I'm pretty sure your server runs in another thread in those.
That's what one would think. Maybe not.
Maybe the stuff that got done for system tests got done in a way that affects feature tests.
That's what I was thinking. So, like, I always assumed I would need to switch to system tests for this functionality. And so the RSpec pull request that was opened by @SamPippin, I actually tested early on, and I was like, okay, cool, I switched to system tests. I no longer need database cleaner. Cool. And then eventually that pull request went through some changes and got merged. And a bunch of people, I subscribed to it because I commented on it, and I was curious about when it closed. And a bunch of people
did you use tellmewhenitcloses.com?
I did use tellmewhenitcloses.com, but I'm also still subscribed to it because I had commented on it and did not unsubscribe.
Sure.
But a bunch of people were commenting saying, like, even after it closed, were saying like, hey, when's this going to be in a release? Because I want to use it. I want to use it in this. I want to get rid of database cleaner. I want to do this. I want to do the other thing. And somebody posted who is not an RSpec maintainer, but was like, this works fine. You can just you can do this with feature specs today. And so I was like, is this true? And so I took Hub, which is one of our internal projects, and it has, you know, some tests that are driven by Capybara WebKit and some tests that are not. And first I upgraded to Rails 5.1, and then I removed database cleaner and all the tests pass. And I was like, interesting. So I pushed it up to GitHub so that it would run on CircleCI, expecting like maybe in that environment things will fail. And they didn't fail. And it's been over a week now, and things are just running fine. So I think...
So I have two questions.
Yeah.
Did you try... on Rails 5.0, removing database cleaner?
That's a good question. I should do that. I should.
So I'm actually curious if just your tests are passing because your tests are written in such a way that they work regardless of what existing data was already in the database.
I find that hard to believe that we would not get into a situation where like a page assertion took longer than it took for the transaction to clean up on the back in the background. I guess that would only matter. Maybe we're just writing the tests in a way that it doesn't matter. When would that matter, that the data gets cleaned up? Only if went back to the database for an assertion.
Or if you're asserting, like, expect the page to have one div with this selector. Like, if you had, like, an element for every topic, and you were like, expect the page to have one div with the topic class on it, if there was existing data in the database before the test ran, then it would fail.
All right, because now we're never cleaning it out. Yeah, I would find that hard to believe that we're never cleaning it out by anything other than a transaction. I'd really find that.
I guess actually, you wouldn't be running in a transaction. Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting.
Well, now I'm like, maybe we just have to do this live on air.
Yeah, so that would be the way to test this, I think, is just go back to your commit where you were on 5.0 and remove database cleaner and see if the tests fail.
Okay, so I have checked out back to a version of the project that's running Active Record 5.0.6. Well, in Rails 5.0.6 and database cleaner, I will jump into my Rails helper file. And where do we set up database cleaner?
Spec support database cleaner, something like that, probably.
Probably, yeah. First thing, I'm going to turn on transactional fixtures again.
Your test will definitely fail if you turn that on.
That's what I want to turn on. I want transactions, right? I mean, that's when I...
Did you turn that on in Rails 5.1?
Yes. When I removed database cleaner, I turned on transactional fixtures.
Okay, if you had transactions turned on and your tests were passing, then yeah, whatever we did definitely affected integration tests as well as system tests otherwise the server should not be able to see any data.
Right, correct. So yes, I did turn on the transactions because I was like, I need transactions.
Unless you're not creating the data in your test. Are you creating the data like by visiting a page on the server?
I don't know if any of the tests are doing that. Here, let's just continue with my with my experiment here. Find the database cleaner.
Yeah.
Let me just comment out everything in the database cleaner file. Okay, So that very exciting work is done. I've commented out the database cleaner configuration. I turned on transactional fixtures, and I'm running the test suite again. It's a 2-minute test suite, so we'll insert some music here, and we'll be back in 2 minutes. So far, so good. This is very exciting. I see a lot of green dots. I'll do the play-by-play here. It is being randomized with seed 17891. The green dots are moving across the screen. They're marching, unimpeded by red or yellow. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Two test failures.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah, so it's still running, but I got two Fs. I mean, I didn't run the test suite before to make sure that it worked at this commit, but I'm pretty confident it did. So yeah, I think I'm like 98% sure that it's just fine. And also, like, a couple other people, like Greg, who works on Hound, immediately went and did the same thing after I did it. Was like, yeah, it works. It's fine.
Yeah, the stuff that we did that forces a server to use the same connection as the test that's running, that must have been something that affects integration tests in addition to system tests.
Yeah.
I thought we did it in a way that only affected system tests, but I guess not.
Yeah, so anyway, it appears as though we're running in a post-database cleaner world now, which is exciting, I think.
Yeah.
Because just transactions, and it's faster, and it's better. It's easier to reason about, and you don't have to worry about getting your configuration wrong.
Yeah, the way it's implemented is such that the tests are impossible to run in parallel.
Oh, great.
But that was already the case if you weren't using transactions.
Right.
This one is, if nothing else, this approach will eventually be able to be made parallel much more easily.
In parallel and against the same database.
Right.
Because approaches to run parallel that I'm familiar with before this were always running against different instances of the database as well.
Right. No, I'm talking like literally just run your same test suite, but with four threads and one test at a time per thread instead of one thread.
Yeah. And I think that @SamFippen was under the same impression that you were, because in the blog post where he announced, like, the system test came to RSpec basically yesterday when they released RSpec Rails 3.7.
Yeah.
And in that blog post, he suggests that people move to system tests from feature tests over time, because one of the reasons was that you'll be able to take advantage of not having to use something like database cleaner. And I basically reached out to him on our Slack to say, like, hey, this works fine with me on feature tests still. So that's one reason to not worry about it. I just also, in general, don't think that if you have a thing that's working right now, I wouldn't like migrate your tests from feature tests to system tests.
Sure.
It's not entire. I mean, it's pretty trivial to do, I guess. And it would allow you to get rid of some things potentially, but like, I guess you can't use the feature DSL if you use that in your feature tests, because that opts you back into a feature test automatically. So you have to switch to describe and it rather than feature and scenario, if that's a thing you use.
Mm-hmm.
And just a few other small things, but it just seems like a change for change's sake, I guess.
Sorry, I'm trying to find this code where we force the server to use the same connection.
My test suite is still running over here, but lots of failures now. We're up to like 10 failures.
Okay, well, that pretty much cinches it that whatever we did, wherever it's being done, I remember it was something that was just like a super implicit mutex check.
Yeah, and all these failures that are coming down are like, can't find the record with this ID, or like, because the transaction has finished and it got cleaned up, and or actually no, it just doesn't have access to it because it's running in a different process. And the transaction,
different thread,
right?
Yeah, so therefore has a different database connection.
Right. So anyway. Listeners can go out and maybe if they're upgraded, that's a good reason to upgrade to Rails 5.1. It was one of the reasons like Hub wasn't on Rails 5.1. And I was like, I want to see if this works. So I upgraded it to Rails 5.1 first. And it was like the reason to do it for me was to see if I could then get rid of database cleaner. Now, it is kind of like a set it and forget it thing. Once you get the configuration right, you don't really have to worry about it. But I like getting rid of dependencies.
Yeah. No, and definitely running your test inside of a transaction is a much faster and more, I guess, consistent, for lack of a better word, way to ensure that your data is in fact clean between test runs.
I did run into like a small issue when I did this, which was this project, I had moved it to use our bin setup script when it runs on CI,
mm-hmm.
which was totally fine because you run bin setup on CI, but then the first thing your test suite does is start with a database cleaner.clean to make sure that like if RSpec crashed beforehand, it cleans up any data that's there. So it also happens to clean up any of the development seed data that got inserted in the database. But without database cleaner running, when the test kicked off, all of the stuff that happened from all of the like development seed data that bin setup ends up inserting ends up still being there during the test and throws off various tests.
Yeah, maybe bin setup shouldn't seed the database.
Well, ultimately, I like thought about, I was like, okay, maybe it shouldn't see the database. Maybe we should only see the database in, like, in our bin setup script. We have this limited set of, like, only do this if you're not on CI. And so I was like, maybe that should be one of the things. But I don't like to put stuff in there, because then that, like, the point of running the bin setup script on CI is so that you test the bin setup script.
Right.
And then ultimately I was like, oh, I know what I do. And I just changed it to, like, I changed the circle CI configuration so that it doesn't just run bin setup. It runs Rails env equal development bin setup. And it works, right? Because it creates a develop, that'll create a development and a test database, seed the development database, and then when the tests start up, it's like it's exactly like you would do it on your computer.
Sure, right? But I still don't think you should seed your database from bin setup. I like bin setup to be as idempotent as possible, and seeding the database is inherently not.
Well, I like to run that when it's like, I just want to go back to square one, right?
Sure.
So basically, I run dbreset, which, as part of DB reset, I think DB setup is included, which does a DB, which does DB seed.
Which does seed, yeah.
So seeds are one thing, but then there's this there's development seeds on top of that. And I could argue whether or not you needed development seeds on top of that.
Well, and also, like, let's say another reason you might want to run it though is like, oh, since I last worked on this project, there are like 3 new dependencies added, and I would like to have those running. But then I also have a development database that I would like to not clobber.
Yeah. And on projects that I'm on long enough, I typically end up breaking out the bin setup script into several different things, which are like bin dependencies. And so like bin setup will call bin dependencies as part of what, so then you could run bin dependencies or bin m file, or like I've been on some projects where they try and like do, like right now our simple bin setup file will be like, does a .m file exist? Then don't do anything. If a .n file doesn't exist, then copy this like sample file over. But then you run into issues where like required keys have been added and they're not in your copy, et cetera, et cetera. So I've seen scripts that like try to rectify that difference. And I like that. I generally like that approach of building bin setup out of several other smaller things as the project needs evolve. It's like building abstractions, right?
Yeah.
Project setup abstractions.
Wasn't, just random thing related to bin files, wasn't Bundler talking about changing the folder it puts bin stubs in from bin to exe?
No, I don't know. Maybe.
Was that I feel like I remember hearing somebody talking about that. I don't know if it was a thing that ever landed or not.
Why?
The argument being that the files in your bin folder aren't binary. They're executable.
But
ignoring the fact that like your Mac comes with things in /user/bin, which are not binary files.
Bundler template moves bins to exe. Bundler 1.8 moves the executables directory in generated gem specs from bin to exe. So that's when you use like bundle gem, I think.
So it won't affect existing gems, just any new,
right?
Anything that uses bundle in it.
Bundle
or
gem.
Bundle gem, whatever, right. Whatever the command is.
Right. Yeah, I think that's the scope of this. I assume when you run bundle, like I've run bundle bin stub recently and it still dumps a bin stub to the bin folder.
Gotcha.
Okay. That's weird.
On that same topic. Since you were mentioning earlier, changing things for the sake of changing things.
Yeah. I'm just like scanning the blog post for it, and it says like RSpec, for example, has had its executable in EXE since 2011. So I guess some people have been using EXE for a while anyway, but I don't know. I guess, I mean, that's the kind of thing.
Why, like, does bin RSpec work? Now I'm confused.
Because RSpec, the gem keeping its executables in EXE, is different than a bin stub a client or like a developer generates when they run bundle bin stub.
Oh, I gotcha. And it's just putting the exe directory on your path.
Right.
Gotcha. Okay.
Right. And the bin stub is different than that. Huh. It's just like it creates a shell script, basically, that you can execute. An executable, if you will.
Now I'm just curious if there's anything. Nope, it's just RBN shims.
I don't know. We'll link to the blog post. I've only scanned it, so we'll link to it in the show notes. It'd be a good read for everybody.
Yeah. Sorry, that was just a thing that came to mind. So what else have you been working on?
Yeah, so I'm on a new project. I got to run Rails new for the first time in several years.
Ooh, as opposed to bin setup?
Yep, usually I come on to a already existing project. And I had a decision to make. So Thoughtbot has Suspenders, which is a like generator for Rails projects. And it predates the time when Rails had like a template system. And it also does some things in addition to what you'd be able to do with Rails templating system. So it's a little more heavy-handed than that. And it kind of has like some of our best practice project setup And also, like, you're probably going to need this, so I've added this gem and a configuration for it, and, like, I'm requiring an environment variable for this. And so, like, I started off by running suspenders, and then I looked at all the stuff it generated, and I was like, you know, I don't actually need any of this. And I've become, like, through years of, like, working on projects that I didn't get to generate myself, I've become rather proficient at remembering what's in suspenders and being able to go to the templates it uses and pull them out and copy them over. So I know what's there that I like. And so I ended up just running Rails new, except...
And then you took RSpec?
Yeah. I took the RSpec configuration. I took some, like...
Email?
I took out the email because this application wasn't going to need... That was one of the things. I was like, I don't even need email. Why do I have all this email set up? I don't, like... And, like, I'm at a point where I've done enough Rails where I know how to, like... I'm not worried where if I, like, skip the active job framework and later I need active job... How do I, like, I know how to put that back, right? So, like, I'm not worried about any of that stuff. So I actually ran, the Rails new command I ran was, like, quite lengthy.
Skip turbo length.
Skip. Yep.
Action cable.
Yeah.
Action mailer.
Let me see if I have the Rails new command I ran. Yeah, so I ran Rails new database equals PostgreSQL.
Yes.
Skip keeps, because I don't need that crap. Skip action mailer, skip action cable, skip spring, skip coffee, skip turbo link, skip test, skip system test, skip bundle. And then I went in and modified the bundle myself, and then I gave it a name.
Sure.
And that was it.
Well, I mean, skip bundle literally just means and don't run bundle install.
Right. So there was a bunch of stuff that I do. I was like, wow, this is a very long command that I'm running here. And there was still stuff that I deleted from that. I don't remember what it was, but I was like, oh, yeah, I also don't need this. I really liked the approach of like, oh, this was good enough. We liked this on projects. All projects should probably have this at some early point, or all projects are likely to have this at some early point in their development. So you should just run suspenders new. And I was like, great, I'll run suspenders new or whatever. I think it's just suspenders and then the project name.
Yeah.
And then I did that. And I was like, I actually don't like this. And there's been, like, Mike Burns has been hammering this for a while, the idea of, like, we should make suspenders. Like, I think ultimately if we could do it again, suspenders would be one of those Rails template things where you can give it a template and that would tell it to use Postgres and things like that. And then suspenders is something that you would add to your development group. And then you would say, like, suspenders add Heroku. Suspenders add error tracking. Suspenders add whatever. And it would add, like, our best patterns for that type of work.
I have an idea. What if you guys added a bunch of skip flags to suspenders?
Those are pull requests that come in often. I think there's an open pull request now for, like we decided a while ago that we preferred, for projects, preferred CircleCI to Travis. We still prefer Travis for open source work because it's Matrix. Mm-hmm. I don't think CircleCI has anything like the build Matrix. You could probably do it now that CircleCI has their 2.0 platform with various Docker containers or whatever, but I haven't looked into it. It's pretty simple in Travis with the Matrix.
Sure.
So we made the change that, like, yeah, when you run a suspenders project, you're going to get a CircleCI template so you can run the thing on CircleCI. So somebody opened a pull request that was like, allow you to configure different providers. And, like, if this were a library, I would be like, yeah, cool. You should be able to, but, like, I don't want to be responsible for maintaining a configuration for.
Sure. No, and it doesn't make sense for that either, because the whole point of suspenders is it's what Thoughtbot uses
for
their projects.
Except, as I'm pointing out, it's not necessarily.
Well, other than when you're not using it. But it's not like, oh, but you're not using it because you want to do something different instead of what suspenders gave you. It's because you're not using that feature at all.
Right. My use case for suspenders is more like I want a template to go back and look at and be like, oh, yeah, that's how I did that. Like, what's that line I need for, like, one of the questions I remember asking was like, what's that line I need so that strong parameters raises when there's a bad parameter? Oh, okay, here it is. Copy and paste that.
Right.
Or how do I make translations raise again? Oh, okay, here it is. That kind of thing.
All the things. Aren't those all defaults in production?
I wouldn't want strong parameters to raise in production.
Wouldn't?
No.
Huh. Okay.
Why would you want strong parameters to raise in production?
Because the only reason it would ever be going off is because of either a bug or somebody trying to hack the application.
Right, and somebody trying to hack the application is frequent enough and harmless enough for the most part that, like...
I don't give a shit if they see a 500, though.
Or also, like, consider the situation where... Well, but I care if they see a 500 and I get it in my error tracker. And it's an inactionable 500, right? Nate, who we also frequently subtweet on this podcast, he had a post on Twitter where he was asking for people's opinion on a change he wanted to make to Sentry, which was like the list of exceptions to be ignored by default.
Right. Anything that was a 4XX error code, have that
right.
be ignored.
Right. And so that included strong parameters type stuff. And that was the one that I kind of, because that generates a 422 maybe?
Or, yeah. Unprocessable entity, I think.
Yeah. And so he tried to like trace through and figure out what, and that like strong parameters was the strong parameter related errors were the ones I was like, if I hit these in production, I probably want to know about these, I guess.
Although I guess you don't hit those in production since the default is not to raise.
Right. Or at least it is in my projects. Yeah. And the reason being like, if for whatever reason I add a new field to an existing form and I, for some reason, don't add test coverage for that field, and I miss the fact that there's an unpermitted parameter that I'm sending.
It's a bug,
but I don't know. Yeah, I guess I probably would want to be alerted to that immediately. There are definitely use cases that, like, it's a case-by-case kind of thing. Like, if I add date of birth to the user sign-up form, and all of a sudden all of my user sign-ups fail with a 422 error rather than just going through and silently ignoring the date of birth field, right? Like, you have to decide which one of those is worse. Like, I think there's an argument to be made that, like, just let user signups continue and we'll figure out the date of birth thing when we're like, why are all these users' date of birth not happening?
Well, so now we're getting into the realm of, like, you could also argue, well, then you should be using MySQL instead of Postgres, because sometimes MySQL will just silently drop data instead of erroring.
You're so hard on MySQL.
Or Mongo, actually.
Yeah, there we go.
Matter.
We'll go with Mongo. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I would just prefer to add the test coverage, right?
Right.
And try not to forget to add the test coverage, but
right. In which case, it shouldn't error in production unless somebody is trying to hack your application.
Right, and if it's an existing form, like even if you leave that field blank, it should still come through as a parameter.
Yeah, it'll case, come through right. as an empty string.
Right. All right, I'm with you. Anyway, so all those errors, I kind of supported, like, 'cause I've seen enough error trackers where that stuff just hangs out there forever. Another one that, like, I guess early on in a project, I almost always want to know about everything because
right.
the number of users are so low that it's easy to manage. But the minute, like, a site gets discovered by bots, it's like, I don't care about any. I don't care about routing
right,
errors.
Now you don't care about Active
I don't
record,
care about 404. I don't care
about,
like, so the set of stuff that I care about changes. And I guess I'd be okay with defaulting to the set of things that I will care about 6 months down the road rather than starting with having to remember to, like, go back and add those things to the error tracker or come onto a project that has an overwhelmed error tracker and try and be like, no, we need to start ignoring these things. And yes, there might be actual programming errors in here, but the noise is so loud that it's
right.
completely worthless to find.
No, and I remember which one it was. I replied that there was something that results in a 400 code that sometimes, I think it might have been 404. Like, sometimes you are getting those as the result of a programmer error, but it's basically impossible to distinguish programmatically, like, did this 404 happen because of a bug, or did it happen because a bot is crawling the site, or because users are clicking on things that they deleted?
Right.
So it definitely makes sense to only track 500 by default. Speaking of server errors, I had a funny interaction on Twitter yesterday. Not really funny, but just, I don't know, I found it amusing. I got a HTC Vive,
mm-hmm.
and I was trying to set it up, and it needs me to sign in with an account in order to install the software. And so I tried to log in with my Steam account because they have a couple of different OAuth integrations. And it comes back to just a blank white page that says server error and nothing else. And so I tweet at HTC Help, and I'm like, yo, I can't install the software because your OAuth endpoint is 500-ing. And they reply, can you try in a different browser? Like, that's not how server errors work. Oh, I see. Can you try clearing your cookies? That's not how server errors work.
Oh, but it could be. Come on, you know that it could be, especially
okay,
the cookies
be,
thing.
No, it absolutely could be. Like, they're doing well. It's still not my fault. It's what they're doing with my cookies. But clearing cookies, I could totally see that making a difference, other than that I had never been to this website before, so there was no way that they had a cookie for me.
Right. Did you get it installed?
Yes. Their
Did you
other
use a different
OAuth
browser?
Integration, no. Their other OAuth integrations were less broken.
Okay. But not completely unbroken, just less broken.
If one of them's broken, I refuse to believe that any of them are completely not broken.
I saw your tweet about your first experience with your HTC Vive.
Banging my head into the floor.
Yeah. So what exactly? So there was a hole.
Yeah, so I was on the floor. There was a panel. I lifted up the panel, and then there was a hole in the floor, and I wanted to see what was in the hole, so I tried sticking my head in the hole. Shockingly, there was a floor there because VR does not magically create holes in my floor, and so I hit my head really hard on my floor.
I would love to have a video of that. I just think watching people play VR is better than playing VR in many cases. And I think that that would be one of those. I'd be like, what's he doing? And then.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
It's an immersive piece of technology. I will give them that.
Have you been enjoying it though? You know, other than, you know, banging your head on the floor.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. I played with it some more this morning.
Cool.
And yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things, like, I was playing a game called The Talos Principle, which I've played before, but they just released a VR version this week. And it was one of the things where I just, like, mundane pieces of, like, scenery, I would continuously, like, stop and be like, oh, I can just, like, look around, you know, like, actually interact with this random piece of scenery that's always been there. But now, I don't know, when there's just a random headless statue, but you feel like you're actually standing next to the giant headless statue.
Right.
Suddenly the headless statue is really interesting.
Yeah.
And there was one thing I was doing where, like, it had you standing sort of on the edge of a cliff, and I'm a little afraid of heights, so I actually, like, started to look over and was like, oh, I need to turn off this game now.
Yeah, that wouldn't go well for me. I'm very much afraid of heights.
Yeah. It's a little jarring when you die in a game in VR, though.
If you die in VR, do you die in real life?
No, but I mean, like, when a thing comes at you and explodes and now all of a sudden it's actually in your face, it's very, like, jarring.
I can imagine that if the experience was, particularly if it was immersive enough. I haven't really done anything other than, like, holding the phone up to your face kind of stuff.
Right.
Which was, like, meh, whatever.
And this is definitely a solid step above that in terms of immersiveness.
Cool. All right. Do you have anything else? What else should we talk about?
We talk about Balloon Fiesta.
Oh, how was Balloon Fiesta? I saw some photos.
It was great. Do you remember Joanne? She used to work in Denver.
Yeah, of course I remember.
Yeah, she came out to visit. So she was out here this weekend and we all went to Balloon Fiesta. I started paying attention more to the countries that all the balloons were from, because you can tell there's a call sign on the side of the balloon and it'll always be a letter hyphen a bunch of other letters and or numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I only started looking at it because I thought it was funny. There were some penguin balloons and their call sign is Gwyn's. G-UINS, and then the other penguin is the same thing but with a Z. But it turns out that if the first letter is G, that means that the balloon was made in the UK. And okay. if the first section, it's actually not necessarily always one letter, because Brazil is PP. Mm-hmm. And there's also a lot of balloons that were made in Brazil, which I found interesting. I think those were really the only two that I noticed. But once I started looking for it, I'm like, oh, there's a lot of balloons here from the UK or from Brazil. Not necessarily meaning that the balloon is the owner lives there or that, you know, it frequently flies there, but that's where it was made. So
that's where the balloon was manufactured.
Yeah. I believe Cameron, kind of the main balloon supplier, I believe they do all their manufacturing in the U.S.
Did you get to go in a balloon this year?
I did not. No, I did not go flying this year.
Mm. Do you own a balloon? Will you shortly own a balloon?
Probably next year. Yeah, I'm gonna buy one.
A balloon is a thing that you. So it's not like an airplane where you're like, I own a piece of this airplane. You just like buy a balloon and a basket and.
Yep.
And you store that at your house somewhere and.
You store it in a trailer.
Okay.
Just like a little, like, you know the little tiny U-Haul trailers, like the smallest size that you can get.
Mm-hmm.
That's like almost a cube, but maybe a little longer.
Yep.
Basically, a trailer that size. The envelope is rough when it's stored is roughly the same size as the basket. It goes into a giant bag.
Yep.
So roughly two basket sizes of storage is what you need. And you put that, you just have that in a trailer. And we always just kept the trailer in our driveway.
If you had a large enough backyard, could you just like, I'm going to go for a balloon flight now? Or what are the regulations on this?
So I actually don't know. As long as it's safe, I don't think there's any reason that you wouldn't be allowed to launch from your backyard. Generally, you need to fly 1,000 feet over the nearest building in a half-mile radius and 500 feet over the nearest building in a one-mile radius.
Okay.
And beyond that, the regulation is basically, like, don't do dangerous things.
Okay. So, like, in a small area, you'd be fine somewhere around, like, 1,500 feet.
Yeah. I mean, nobody actually flies as high as we're supposed to.
Oh, okay. All right.
But
I feel like I used to see more balloons around. I haven't seen balloons in a while.
They're definitely still around here. Although they've been scaling back Balloon Fiesta because they're running out of places to land. So it used to be over 1,000, and now it's only about 750 balloons.
How do you get in? You just pay?
To Fiesta?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To, if you're going to fly your balloon.
Oh, to fly your balloon.
Yeah, if there's a competitive number of slots. Is it like a charity thing? How does this work?
I've never flown for Balloon Fiesta, so I don't know if there's a fee or not. Because I don't have a commercial license. I've never had a commercial license. And you have to be a commercial pilot to fly Fiesta.
Okay.
So I don't know, actually, how that process goes. I know that you get the codes to the gates when you get your pilot's license. Because people take off from there not during Fiesta.
Cool.
But yeah, I don't know. It's one of the things, like, it's surprisingly easy to get a pilot's license. It's actually easier than getting a driver's license. It's roughly the same process, though. Take a written test, get a provisional permit, fly 10 hours with a licensed pilot, have them sign your flight book, take another written exam. And it's all self-administered by, I mean, it's by people who are licensed by the FAA, but who aren't necessarily like part of the FAA.
Right.
And then it seems like the ballooning community here just generally has an agreement with the FAA of like, if somebody in a neighborhood is complaining about noise, don't fly around that neighborhood for a couple of weeks. Don't land at the airport. And as long as people do that, the FAA mostly leaves us alone.
Landing on a runway would be.
So you legally have the right to. It is public property.
Wait, what?
You legally have the right to land at an airport.
Stop it.
Yeah.
So if I have my own, airplane, I can just I just like contact the tower and be like, what runway am I landing on?
But I mean, you know, you're gonna have to wait until they clear you to land, and you'll have to file a flight plan with them. But you can just do that.
Is this one of those things where like I could land, but then I wouldn't be able to disembark anywhere because the gates aren't public land? And like...
No, that's not at all. No, so they'll just get really mad at you.
Okay, because I'm not a commercial airliner that has like a financial relationship with the airport.
Well, it's more balloons in particular. Like, we're going to be clogging up that runway for a good while.
Right, we don't get to just roll away.
Right, and so it's not just like, okay, it's slightly annoying to get you onto a runway. It's like they're going to have to divert commercial airlines.
They'll be like, you can land at 2 a.m, just hang around.
Right, but so that's the thing. They have to land you in a reasonable period of time. And balloons, basically, when you say I'm looking to land, they have to land you right away. More or less. And in aviation, the least maneuverable aircraft has the right of way. Right. There is no aircraft less maneuverable than a hot air balloon.
All right. I can't wait till you get your own balloon and land it at the airport.
No, every year there's some idiot who lands at the airport during Fiesta and it's a mess. Yeah, balloons are fun though.
All right. Let me know when you get your balloon. I'll come watch you from the ground.
Okay.
Didn't you say you're afraid of heights?
Yeah, not in a balloon though. I don't know why.
I'm not afraid of heights in a plane, but I think I'd be very afraid of heights in a balloon for some reason.
I don't know. I grew up in balloons, so.
Grew up in balloons. Balloon
school.
My
mom was continuously pointing out to me all weekend that my first balloon ride was when I was 3 days old.
Oh.
Nice. I was actually surprised how good Ruby was around the Fiesta, because most babies, when the burners start going, they start flipping out, and Ruby is just like, oh, that's cool.
Cool.
Oh, that one's cool, too. Okay, I'm going back to sleep now. If anybody wants to come next year, it is always the first 2 weekends of October, and it's definitely a thing to see at some point in your life.
All right, with that, should we wrap up?
Sure.
All right. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/130.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about this episode or any other episode, you can tweet us at _bikeshed, email us at host@bikeshed.fm, or leave a comment on the website.
Thanks for listening to The Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.